So today, I think we're going to talk NFT marketplaces. So I know I've had a
Cool.
lot of experience on the producing side of a marketplace, so I can talk very intimately about that. And I think you've had a lot of experience on the consumption side, the producing side of assets for marketplaces, like listing and sort of like the nuances of that world and that sort of ecosystem. So I'll talk a little bit about marketplaces, what's involved.
So I think maybe we start with like a lay of the land, like what's out there right now, right? I was thinking like some of the big ones are pretty obvious, right? We got OpenSea. There's LooksRare, which is like one of their competitors. And then there's stuff like Rarible, where they focused on like a lot more on the creation side than the marketplace side, I'd say. And then you have like the more niche ones like that are gated, like SuperRare or Foundation or something like that. At least this we're talking just ETH, I guess, here.
Yeah, and then on the non-Eve side, you've got different ecosystems with different sort of layouts. So on the non-Eve side, there's Tezos, which is pretty big in the NFT community. So that's Hik Et Nunk. yeah,
What?
Hik Et Nunk, which is let me list that. It's like one of the earliest ones. And I forgot what it means, but it's Latin for this and that, I think. But it may not be that this and that. My Latin is long gone, but I'll share that. And so this is for the DAO, but itself is Hik Et Nunk. Which is like a Tezos NFT marketplace. It does all the same sort of things. There are NFTs on Solana, but I can't tell you exactly the major one, but I know Melania Trump did a drop on Solana.
Yeah, Magic Eden
So
is the big one over there.
Magic Feed, yeah. So there's Magic Feed.
No,
And then on near
Magic Eden, right? And
Magic
then
Eden,
there's
yeah,
another
that's what it
one that
is.
is called SoulSea. So there's like yeah, two big ones over there. SoulSea. SoulSea is another big one, right?
Yeah, SoulSea. That's right. And then on Near, there are two major ones, and a lot of little marketplaces, sort of up and coming. So there's Paras, there's Mintbase, and then and I think Mintbase used to be on ETH at some point. And then there's Few and Far, which is coming up. And then there was my marketplace. Still is my marketplace. Encourage you to use it. It's a little bit different because it's more about swapping NFTs between people, Swapland, and then yeah, and then a bunch of others that are just kind of in the background, sort of percolating. I think there's Satori, which maybe has a marketplace coming up. So those are just some interesting places that are in the marketplace game to trade. And then there are aggregators too. So super, super secondary markets like PseudoSwap. And then maybe there's a couple of the others that are kind of like NFT kind of trading platforms like NFT20.io. Would you consider that to be a marketplace?
I think, yeah, like in some way, I see those ones as like tools or like liquidity providers, but like maybe that's what marketplaces are like becoming is just more of like liquidity providers, like with OpenSea's new feature around doing collection bids, like collection-wide bids. So it's interesting to see.
It's kind of interesting, but I think you have to really look at like the overall idea of marketplace dynamics and like where things happen, and then like what is the real sort of product differentiation between a marketplace. I think one of the things is like I think when we talk about sort of the larger ones like Super Rare and like Foundation and like sort of those kinds of services, what we're really talking about is curation, I think, as a service to a certain extent, because I think when you think like raw like marketplaces, I think it's a race to the bottom, right? When it comes to like fees and things like that, I think consumers end up like sort of racing towards the bottom unless there's like real product differentiation. So I think I know that LooksRare has really been sort of trying to push this whole community involvement in trying to get like more people involved in curation. And so it's like, how can we like add value that isn't just like cost-cutting measures? Because I think when you look at, like you were talking about how marketplaces are becoming liquidity providers, when you look at like a market like PseudoSwap, for those that don't know, PseudoSwap used to be more of just like a trading platform for direct peer-to-peer swaps. So it's like, oh, I had a Bored Ape and I'll trade you my Bored Ape for a Mutant Ape and like, I don't know, 1,000 ApeCoin. And so they were doing that as like a free service on top of like donations, etc. And they kind of came to this like conclusion that like that wasn't working. And so they needed, people wanted tools to sort of reduce the friction and management of like NFTs. So like I think maybe as like a lister or like a creator of a collection, you might have different expectations on like managing who's buying and selling your collection and at like what rate. So like people want to be able to like set the floor or have options to give people like a way out without like say just like saying, oh, I purchased this NFT for say $1,000 and the market's not going so great and I know that I can't flip this for any money, so what I'm gonna do is I'm just gonna sell it for 100. And so like what a creator might do is they may say, hey, look, I'm gonna create an automated market maker for that NFT. And so like what that means is I'm going to set aside some money as a creator to allow people to sell their NFTs back to me or as a large holder, and then I'll give you back some money that you paid for this. And in exchange, I'm going to allow that item to be in the pool of purchased NFTs that other people can buy from the same pool at a particular price. And as the pool gets smaller, the price goes up. So it's a way to sort of balance the buying and selling of the NFTs without actually having to actively manage. And so PseudoSwap found that they were able to create more of a marketplace there. And with that, there's like a lot of good and bad. So the bad side is that PseudoSwap really leans into this minimization of fees as like somewhat of a business to the point where they cut out creator royalties in the middle. Something they really shouldn't be doing, but and we've talked about this before, but it's up to them to be able to like make that change, so to speak. So it's really kind of an interesting dynamic where if you have the same product roughly across like many different channels, then competition is quite high. And then competition for the same sort of like actions, then kind of like acts as a forcing function for a reduction in fees. And I think you can kind of see this in like the Near ecosystem. So in Near, there is still a very large marketplace that's a large like holder where they were charging 5% fee on like listings. But they were mostly the only one. And then sort of new competitors came to the fore. And so that in itself like kind of helped induce them, plus like maybe community pressure to lower their like sort of commission on sales to like 2%, right? And like if you look long term, the only place you can see that falling is to like 1%, because if someone else is willing to like more, we're up and coming, we can do all the same things you're doing this other thing, but we're only going to take 1% on top of that. That kind of gives people that kind of incentive. If you're just looking at like marketplace to marketplace, apples to apples, to then like race towards the bottom. And I think if you look at the major players, that's part of the impetus behind OpenSea, like sort of rewinding and thinking, okay, well, what kind of features can we add? Is it a record label? Is it automatic market making for people? Like, how can we capture more value that isn't really just us being, hey, list your stuff here, and then we'll charge you a fee that's small and like extract the value. So people are looking to innovate on top, I think.
Yeah, and I think like it's just what's gonna happen, right? If you find one that's lower priced without fees on another marketplace and you're looking to get into that community, you're gonna be looking for the best deal. You might not necessarily care that the royalties go to the creators or not.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, I think that's one thing. And I think the other thing is the move towards curation. So we live in a crazy world, emerging world, right? Where like every day the AI machine gets smarter and smarter. So like when you look at technologies like DALL-E, going open, we'll say, and then you look at, and I think you linked me to an NFT drop recently that was all just AI generated like EFPs, right?
Yeah,
So
it was like
that,
Exolians.
yeah. So like, let's see if we can find it actually. Xolians. Okay, so. So when you look at the ability to like start using AI to generate images, etc., it starts to mean that you're gonna start seeing the the quality metrics start to fall. And then like if you look at, and I think Matt Driehaus and Holly Herndon's like Interdependence podcast touched on this. And like an episode maybe last year or maybe 8 months ago or something like that, where they're saying like if you take a traditional art institution, like the purpose and function of a gallery is partially curation. So I think what we're going to start to see within the market is more curatorial tools, and that's going to be just a function of sheer volume. And then when you get to curation, you're getting to this place where you're having added value to things. And so I think we're going to see NFTs that are exclusive, like where you're not going to just see like wild public mintings of things instead, and which you already start to see this with the advent of allow lists and these kind of pre-sales. But I think you're going to see. I think you're going to see where people are going to want you to have an NFT reputation before you're allowed to even bid on like sats of NFTs. And I think you can see that emerging because, like, just firstly out of necessity, just because, like, oh, there's a million items here. How do we pick which one? Which I think looks where Rare put out that proposal on their forum. I think you linked me to it at one point, where they were saying, like, hey, look, we don't want to be the gatekeepers, or maybe it was Super Rare.
Yeah, this is super rare.
Super Rare, yeah, that's what it was. So, like, Super Rare is saying, like, we don't want to be the gatekeepers of, like, who gets the list on our platform. We did this for technical reasons in the beginning. And then, like, from a startup perspective, people are often citing the Airbnb effect. Well, I'll coin it that, where, like, Airbnb in the beginning went through this period where anybody could list anything. People weren't taking very good photos of their place. They weren't calling them like anything that looked nice. So what Airbnb did is they decided to create a culture of like high quality stuff. So they went around and like photographed all of the apartments themselves with professional photographers. They helped people approve listings until there was enough high quality on Airbnb to where they just like didn't personally have to do that themselves. They could just occasionally go out and find like a super host and do some like amazing curated stuff to just augment what's going on. But typically, if you're going to list your place on Airbnb and you make it look like crap, you have no expectations of ever getting booked. Or you know you're setting yourself up for a wild ride. One or the other. So I think Super Rare took that approach to building community, but then they realized, oh, we don't want to be the gatekeepers. Plus, if there's not enough like diversity and like work that's being offered, people are going to go elsewhere, and we can't keep up with the demand for curation. So let's try and build a system where people are curating themselves, and they themselves create lists. And for creating these lists, they can get rewarded in some sort of way. And they avoided using token curated registries for some reason. I'm not sure. I think it's mostly because no one's actually done it really successfully. There was AdChain from like 2017 or something like that. But like we're in 2022. So there's some hesitancy on like the technical complicatedness of doing something like that. And I think they were lower hanging fruit to do that. But the interesting thing is that focus on curation. And I think them realizing that they've got to curate this stuff and get other people to curate it is like a smart shift for them to get into the new emerging market of curation.
Yeah, I also think that it's like a great example of like a startup doing something that doesn't scale, right? So usually in startups, especially like Airbnb, like an example is what you were saying as well, which is like they're doing stuff like going and taking pictures of people's houses. Like that doesn't scale. You can't do that for everyone, but you can do that if you are starting a startup and you're trying to do, like, for example, Airbnb's like high quality. Like you want your customers to have that first good experience so that they'll come back, spend more money, have more great experiences with your product, right? And in a lot of cases, especially when you're starting out, you don't have it all figured out. You do it like by hand, right? You get people to apply, you accept the good ones, or the same thing with Airbnb. Like maybe you don't accept them all, that kind of thing, right? So I think that also lends really well to the whole art and like art space and curation. So I think there's like a, I think they hit like double there where like it worked out really good on both points, like doing something that doesn't scale and kind of kickstarting this whole like everyone's thinking about the whole curation and like curating from communities and that kind of thing going forward.
Well, yeah, and I think it also tracks the broader trend in like just the way that we consume media today. So like I think if you look at like influencers and things like that, they're essentially cultural curators. They go around, they do a bunch of stuff, and like part of that is like through like market dynamics. Some of that is just through normal life of stuff that they have in the background that you may not even notice. And then if you look at the way like music is going, like there's a radio that I listen to called NTS like radio, and that is all like sort of the anti-algorithm in a certain extent, where it's like, oh, well, let's get as nuanced and niche as we can get. And we'll have like individual DJs and individual people curating music for other people to listen to. Charge a flat fee for that. There's not like token dynamics, but instead what you get is a richer listening experience than necessarily what you would get from a big data analysis of music that you should or shouldn't like. And so what people are actually tuning into are individual curated parts. So I think when it comes to like prompt engineering as well, which I guess is like what we can call this new field of like sort of AI generated art to a certain extent, where like now you're able to generate loads and loads of crap, just crap. And so now you've got to become a curator of the crap, you know? Like it might have taken you like, okay, so let's say if you were a skilled artist, maybe it would have taken you, you would have not done certain things and made different decisions. And like you wouldn't have produced the crap, but now you can produce the crap. And it's just like film, you know? I think someone said, maybe it was Werner Herzog, where he is like, oh, like you can either just like keep recording hours and hundreds and thousands, hundreds of thousands of hours of film, but you know, you're either like, I guess, a photographer or a garbage collector to a certain extent. So that becomes like this whole notion of curation. And like that's inherent in like this idea of the age of like hyper reproducibility that we live in. And so like the tools are for producing more and more works and more and more and more are already there. But I think the tools for curation are like limited and very nascent. So like, but everyone is kind of feeling this pull towards it. So it's going to be interesting to see how we combine the man and the machine in a way that feels like organic and still meshes with like what it is as people we fundamentally want to consume.
Yeah, I think we're starting to see at least some things pop up. Like we've seen these products, like there's like that Deca art. There's also like some other like gallery based ones, like gallery.so and some other ones that I think are like on the very other end of the curation, right? They're not focused really on like, they're not at the like gallery level where they're curating and selling it, but they're at least providing the gallery part, which I think is kind of interesting to see these pop up. Because I feel like there's, like you said, there's enough garbage to sift through now that these platforms are making like a lot more sense. Like just yeah. To talk about Deca art for like a couple seconds here. I really like what they're doing over there at DECA Art and the way that they're incentivizing usage. I think it's pretty interesting. Like, you get like an invite code. Once you're invited, then you can earn DXP for like browsing around the site and following and making galleries, that kind of thing. And yeah, I feel like it's a very interesting approach to the whole gallery scenario in Web3. I think like gallery.so is another good example another similar approach.
Yeah, it's like all really interesting to see how curation is going to play like forward. And what's cool though, I got to say about DECA Art, just for a minute, is that they also allow you to build your own sort of curation list. So it's like you can go and look at other people's collections of stuff, and you can kind of put this and organize it into a bucket, and then all of a sudden you become a producer. And so the project that I did, what was it? The project I did last month, Feedhead. So like Feedhead is that same sort of idea of curation of content, where essentially you would have an NFT itself, and that would be its kind of decentralized invitation to be able to create additional sort of content for that NFT itself. And so that kind of allows you into the curatorial role of stuff that's associated with the feed. And I think you have to be headed towards that realm, just as like all the forces are kind of pushing you towards that direction, as things become like, I don't know, hyper productive in a certain way. But like, I think to get back to marketplaces, I think some of the technical things about marketplaces that often get overlooked are also sort of worth mentioning. So I think in the advertisement for the spaces, I promised fungible, semi-fungible, and non-fungible, and like selling tokens. So I think one of the kind of interesting things that's emerged is the sort of looming SEC regulation around fractional NFTs, and how that can end up being a security by like the Howey test. And then the limitations of ERC 1155. So I guess one of those things that's interesting to have a look at is what are the technical limitations between listings. So as a marketplace creator, one of the things that you have to deal with are the different formats and like implementations of tokens. So there's the NFT standard, which is ERC 721. And on different chains, they have different standards that are kind of like equivalents. And then there's kind of these extensions to the standard. So some of these extensions include like metadata. Some of them include enumeration, which we'll talk about in a second. And then some of them include just like radically kind of different looks. So ERC 1155, which is the multi-token standard, which is a standard where if you could represent an NFT and these fungible tokens in ERC 20, if you may have heard of them, all in a single contract. So you could, in theory, issue fractions of an NFT and say like these tokens represent all of the quote unquote shares of this other NFT, and you end up having this kind of way of breaking up the holdings of a single NFT. So you can imagine a CryptoPunk is too expensive for any one person to hold, but you may have a Punk ERC20 that you hold a part of. So as a marketplace, though, when you're looking at the standards, you really do have to deal with different types of data that you can get out of these tokens. So one of the most pervasive ways of figuring out what's going on with a token is to do this thing called indexing. So to build an index, it means that you need to have information about what tokens were issued, potentially how much was paid. And so there's a set of standard events that your contract is supposed to emit. And this data allows marketplaces to figure out what's going on with your contract. Now, this is kind of complicated when you want to figure out like the current state of something. So what some contracts do is they've implemented these extensions called enumerable. And so enumerable means that you can simply, given a contract address, basically find out all of the data that you want to know on that contract. And so ERC 721 basically has most of the components already baked into the contract. So it makes it not impossible to enumerate. But when you get to the multi-token standard, it's almost impossible to enumerate without some sort of other additional enumeration standard, which isn't wildly proliferated amongst contract holders. So last week we were talking about smart contract upgradability. So the most of these contracts have just like come live within the past couple of years. So the standard hasn't really reached a lot of NFT contracts. And because they don't have a way to actually upgrade, they're kind of stuck with whatever was available at the time. And so from a marketplace perspective, you're kind of now at this weird inflection point where you're supporting older standards and trying to squeeze as much information as you can out of it, and then supporting newer standards, which are easier to sort of iterate through and reason about. And so the reason why I bring this up is because as a marketplace operator, or owner or operator, you have to basically invest a lot more additional sort of processing power and compute to figure out like what's going on with these contracts that are not enumerable. And that in turn affects how many people are willing to list your tokens. So I think that these sort of multi-token standards, et cetera, have kind of stalled out a little bit and their ability to be sort of represented by marketplaces, et cetera, because of the resources that it sort of requires to be able to process the data. And so that means either using a third-party indexing service, outsourcing that to Infura or Alchemy, et cetera, or rolling your own indexing service using something like the graph to try and pull that data out.
Or so, the enumerable standards, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But the only problem there is that not a lot of contracts implement it yet.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I think that's really interesting to think
that, I was gonna say, like, that gets kind of into like, as a marketplace operator, you need to be able to be flexible to support new standards coming up, like enumerable, like, you know, if that was like brand new, for example, or we saw like ERC 721A is kind of like a new thing. that's kind of getting some traction. And then we have like diamonds, right? Where like, for example, Etherscan still doesn't support diamonds that well as opposed to proxies. But it would be great to see NFT marketplaces have, well, we've seen at least OpenSea has upgraded and now they're using Seaport. So it seems like these marketplaces are on the right track.
Yeah, for sure. I guess, Shane, can you talk a little bit about your experiences like listing on these marketplaces and like how has that been in terms of like compatibility and seeing like what happens when you make something directly on the platform versus like do self-custody, self-ownership, your own contract, which I know you've done a lot of the former, well, former or latter, a lot of the making your own contract. Yeah, that's what I'll say.
Yeah, so OpenSea, for example, you can use their pre-made contract to do your own NFT, upload the image, that kind of stuff. And then you can sell it right on OpenSea. It's even has some gas savings built in. I obviously did not take that route. I built my own contracts because I want the art to be on chain. I want it to be pixel art. I have, you know, all of these extra things that are like kind of at the bounds of what's possible. So I can't really use the built-in contracts. So I have to ship my own. And yeah, that presents like quite a bit of issues.
Actually, can you tell us about the process that you typically have to go through? Because like, I think a lot of people aren't really too familiar with like what that looks like.
Like on-chain art or just like your own custom
contract? Just the general, your own custom contract.
Yeah, so obviously it's not generated from the OpenSea user interface, so you are making your own using, say, Truffle or Hard Hat or Remix, something like that. And then I personally use Diamond Standard to be able to break up my contract to different components, have them all kind of come together at the end. And that lets you build contracts more than 24 kilobytes, which Type Knots is for sure. Same with Artifacts, are both over that. And yeah, that's just like the basic is that you want to get your Solidity, you probably want to write it in Solidity, get it compiling, deploying to like a test net first, test all that out. And then
yeah, so like that's a good point there.
Once you put it on yeah, like once you put it on testnet, you can also check out OpenSea's testnets.opensea, and that will let you basically look at all your contracts that you've deployed to testnet and make sure that everything works within their platform. So I think LooksRare has that as well, and a couple other marketplaces. But that's like one big thing that you're going to want to deal with these NFT marketplaces, is that you want to be able to test on their testnet before you ship to production, because you don't want to ship to production and have something go wrong.
Yeah, right. So like that's probably one of my first go-tos too for making is like, okay, make sure it all compiles like locally. A lot of people might use bases for their contracts. So it may be like, oh, let's see what OpenSea does. And I think a lot of like sort of non-technical people that want to still kind of own their own contract can kind of walk their way through. And a lot of people will use like Basie as a base for their smart contract. And like one of the kind of gotchas about that, depending on how you plan on having this mint, is that an NFT summer contract. I'm not saying that you should clone it, but I'm just saying that like that's one of the things that like a patterns that emerges to find an open source contract that's been out there in the wild, a little battle tested. But one of the things that people did is they kind of kept the same mint function name. And so when it came for like mint day that they listed or whatever, what would happen is that a bot would they were able so I would just like call that function something other than mint or mint ape, which is just kind of a weird nuance printed for those that are working on the EVM. But basically, you figure out what contract you want. You use Hardhat, which I linked as one of the more modern compile tools. You can also use like Truffle and Solidity compiler, which is called Solsy. But Hardhat kind of abstracts that away from you. Truffle abstracts that away from you a little bit less. And then the net result is you're left with what's considered. And then you can use the deploy scripts or whatever is baked into the tool of your choice, which could be Hardhat or it could be Truffle. And maybe you can even deploy directly using Remix now. Don't quote me on that. And so Remix, for those of you who don't know, is just like an IDE that works within the browser install any software yourself. You can definitely do a test that for Remix. I can also play the name. I think around 2017, a lot of maybe it was 2018. It's been years. So that's that. Then once you get your contract up, it's check out your testnet listings. So go to your testnet, go to OpenSea testnet, see that like your contract looks well formed, like the images show up. You have any royalties set up, and like I think OpenSea has a bunch of additional things, like traits, and traits allow you to have the little tags on the outside for properties and things like that. And then there's a couple of other things that is very like OpenSea specific. So check the like docs, and then from there, the road to mainnet is like pretty short, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I would be mint. Like, you want to obviously be minting on testnet like for a while and get obviously you want to try and get as many eyes on your code as possible and audit if possible as well. And I guess launch it. And we talked about upgradable contracts last week, so if you have any questions about that, you can go check out last week's episode.
Yeah. And then, like, I guess some sort of pattern in talking about are just like listing aggregators. So, a lot of people are kind of interested in this idea of like, how do we just list this everywhere? And so, I think this speaks back to the point from a technical perspective, marketplaces are allowed to do this thing called approve. So, like, you can do approvals for the NFT. So that way, you as the marketplace can then help someone else exit out of a trade if that happens. So, like, let's say that you list on LooksRare, you list on OpenSea, you list on SuperRare, even though I don't think that's possible, but you list on whatever kind of other platform, could be PseudoSwap or something like that. Then you as a marketplace have to do this thing where you're watching the chain for your for the contracts and for the token IDs that all of a sudden have a change in their listing. And so that allows you to know that the approval has changed and that you can either delist or that the trade won't go through because you don't have the right to perform the swap on behalf of the user. So that's like sort of another thing to consider. And that's kind of how multi-listing like works in this ecosystem. So like if you've listed on a website before, you should check for your approvals to like remove them. If you've delisted, not all marketplaces will remove their access to that. So that's just something to consider.
Yeah, I've seen a couple people get wrecked from that where they had
And so, like, I think when we come through where things are going, you have these like the pressure on like mass aggregation of just getting your token out there to as many places as can like handle it. And then you have the sort of other pressure of more people doing this. So that pushes marketplaces into a spot where the margins are only going to go down on marketplace listing. And so they've got to find a new business. And so this process of finding a new business is interesting. So that's why we see the emergence of some of these more DeFi tools into NFT, where people are trying to do NFT loans, but it's very crude at the moment. And I don't think it's the right approach to that. And then the fractionalization of NFTs, but that's under the threat of, like, say, the SEC. And so marketplaces got to have a place to go. And so we're probably going to see more curation and probably coordination and collaboration tools built into marketplaces to try and find the next market.
Yeah, agreed. I think that's a good place
So,
to
Shane, like, what do you
leave.
think of the aggregation and sort of the aggregation of NFTs to all marketplaces? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Or would you want to see these smaller galleries start to become places where people list NFTs as well? Or
Can you
would
hear
you
me?
want to see that your community becomes like a little bit smaller, and is focused on aggregating high quality groups, sort of doing like the traditional artist group show, where you may be in a gallery in a space with like Andy Warhol, Basquiat, Type Knots. Or you can imagine Jack NFT and Xcopy.
Yeah, can you hear me or no?
Yeah, I don't know
Hello?
if you're muted.
Can you hear me?
Or
No?
maybe I'm muted.
Can you hear me or no? Hello?
So, like, I
Hello?
think these are quite like sort of interesting things that are moving towards the future in unexpected ways. I think the space is going to be really interesting to watch within the next 6 months with OpenSea releasing Seaport, which is support for most of the EVMs, and then the advent and the rise of bridging. So that's where people are moving assets from one chain to another, and that has its own complications. Part of that is time, and then the other thing is the cost of doing a migration. And so earlier in, say, NFT summer of 2020, 2021, time's a blur, there was a project called Junkyard Dogs. And so Junkyard Dogs was really focused on creating additional features and functionality for their NFTs but on this kind of secondary market of Polygon. And so you would feed your junkyard dog and you can upgrade it and then move it back to the layer one and then like sell it. So that kind of added functionality because of the cost of the L1s is going to be a little bit different, and it's going to be interesting to see how much more NFTs are valued or curation is needed on L2s. So if you've been in the NFT market for any period of time, you own an NFT, I would encourage you to switch over to Polygon and just look at the things in your wallet. So spam is a big feature of lower cost networks because the cost of minting something or shipping it is just so much exponentially cheaper that you'll find that you get a lot of these sort of spam NFTs in your wallet. And so, from an infrastructure provider and as a marketplace, you're already on the hook for providing curation for not showing junk NFTs and a wallet. And so what some infrastructure providers like Alchemy have started doing is creating these spam filters for these NFTs. And so that's been really an interesting like segment to see emerge from the like system. And so, like, we've been really so I just want for particular the like trying to experiment with and we are this past 6 months, even though it's a bear market, you can see that the tooling is being built to enable more volume of NFTs to be listed and then the emergence of the curation to make sense of it all. So I think Shane's mic is no longer working. His
Yeah,
phone
can you hear me or
overheated.
no?
And so I think this is going to just be the show. So thanks everyone for listening. And next week, we'll see you here.